Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Friday, January 3rd, 2020. President Salva Kiir issues a decree pardoning 30 prisoners in a New Year presidential amnesty.
Unfortunately, today it has been us moving around trying to find out where the process should be, the paperwork. Which until now, as we are speaking now, is 4:20, and nothing has ever happened.
And a deadly plane crash in Sudan kills 16 people.
The plane departed between 5 p.m. to 6 p.m. from Al Jenaina heading to Khartoum, and there were 16 passengers on board, including the military crew. The military personnel were 7 and 9 civilians.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. President Salva Kiir has ordered the release of two prominent South Sudanese civil society activists, Peter Bier and businessman Carbino Wall, in a New Year's pardon. Bier and Wall were sentenced to different jail terms in June last year for allegedly threatening state security. From Juba, Manyang, David Mayar reports for VOA.
The presidential pardon was announced last evening on the state-owned South Sudan Broadcasting Corporation. But Peter Bier and Carbino Wall are still being held at the Juba Central Prison. Defense lawyers say prison authorities have been slow in clearing the necessary paperwork for releasing their clients. Defense lawyer Jack Mayol is one of the lawyers representing both Bier and Wall.
The presidential order, to our understanding, should have taken effect immediately. We understood all the other bureaucracy should have been done before, but unfortunately today it has been us moving around trying to find out where the process should be, the paperwork, which until now, as we are speaking now, is 4:20, and nothing has ever happened.
A South Sudanese court sentenced Bier and Wall to Juba prisons on 11th of June last year, following accusations that they threatened the security of the state. Bier was sentenced to 2 years in prison, while Wall was sentenced to 10 years behind bars. More than 200 relatives of 30 inmates have been camped at the gates of Juba Central Prison for several hours to receive their loved ones who have been imprisoned for years. Ajak says the office of the president should immediately write the order of release to the Ministry of Justice. He says neither the Ministry of Justice nor the Ministry of Interior received the order by the time he addressed reporters staked out at the prison. Ajak says the delay is unfair given the inmates were in custody for more than 6 months.
Some bit of frustration are coming in because people seem not to know what is happening. The institution who are supposed to be handling this seem also not to know what exactly is happening. The Ministry of Interior are waiting for a letter from either the Ministry of Justice or the Office of the President.
Akon Agok, the brother of Carbino Wall, says he was elated to hear his brother would go free.
I was so excited, and immediately upon receiving the news, I informed the family members about the letter of pardon from His Excellency the President, and all of us were overjoyed. We fell with joy and excitement that can never be mentioned.
Akon says he will continue to wait to meet his brother however long it takes.
The days they spent in detention and in the prison are much more than the days, the two or few hours that they will spend again in the prison. We have already received it by faith that they are already released. And even if we don't have them with us at the moment, they are released and we will have them with us either tomorrow or on Monday.
Several human rights defenders, including some U.S. members of Congress, condemned the sentencing of the two men. U.S. Congresswoman Magdalene Dean drew attention to Bier's detention in the U.S. House of Representatives in February last year. For VOA News, I'm Anyang David Mayor in Juba.
From Juba, we move to Sudan, where a Sudanese military plane crashed in western Darfur region on Thursday evening, killing all 16 people on board, including two women and two children, according to Sudanese military officials. A Sudanese employee of the World Food Program and his family were among the casualties. Michael Atit reports for VOA from Khartoum.
Several officers were among those killed when the plane went down in the restless part of West Darfur, which has recently witnessed deadly ethnic clashes. Brigadier General Amir Mohammed Al-Hassan, the Sudanese army spokesperson, says an internal plane crashed shortly after taking off from Al Janina Airport. He says all passengers have perished, including the crew. Speaking in Arabic to South Sudan in Focus by phone from Khartoum, Al-Hassan says among the 9 civilians were 3 legal advisors, 2 women and 2 children.
The plane departed between 5 p.m. to 6 p.m. from Al Janina heading to Khartoum, and there were 16 passengers on board, including the military crew. The military personnel were 7 and 9 civilians.
Al-Hassan says the remains of the victims were collected and buried this afternoon in Al Janina, but added that some bodies were burned beyond recognition.
For sure, all the procedures of burial have been done there. They have done what they could do to collect the remains of the victims. But I'm sure some of them could not be recognized due to the heavy burn on them.
Al-Hassan says the Russian-made plane was under the control of a senior pilot who did not report any technical problems during departure from Khartoum Thursday morning. The plane crashed 5 minutes after taking off. Al-Hassan says military commanders have formed an investigative committee, including technicians and legal aides, to look into the cause of the crash.
This morning, there is an investigative committee which has been formed. Some of them have a technical background and legal personalities, and they are mandated
Sudan's
to carry an investigation on this matter and file a report within
a few days. Narrowly escaped being a victim in the crash. He decided to remain behind 10 minutes before the plane's departure. Speaking to Sudan's national television last night, Abdul Bari said he thanked God for his life. He also sent his condolences to the families of those who perished in the crash. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Khartoum.
A South African photojournalist has returned home after spending 3 years in captivity with the Islamic State in Syria. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
Shiraz Mohammed was taken hostage in early 2017. The charity group Gift of the Givers says Mohammed was in the country to document the plight of Syrians under the nation's grinding, brutal civil war. In December, the charity tweeted that the photojournalist had been freed and was awaiting coordination between the South African and Turkish governments to fly home. Circumstances surrounding Mohammed's release were unclear. The Reuters news agency quoted Gift of the Givers as saying the South African Foreign Ministry had confirmed it was in contact with Turkish intelligence, which had said Mohammed was with them. But the charity had received no more information. Turkey borders northern Syria, where Mohammed was said to have been kidnapped. In a Friday statement, Mohammed's family confirmed his return, but declined to comment further, saying, owing to his recent circumstances, he and our family are requesting that we be given some space. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
The public debt of most African countries is growing rapidly. This coincides with the emergence of China as the biggest financial backer of African infrastructure projects, such as Kenya's new railway. China has replaced the West as the continent's primary creditor. Its debt, that many economists say is unsustainable and in some cases impossible for some countries to ever pay. Today, as part of our look at China's growing presence in Africa, VOA's Darren Taylor in Johannesburg looks at its role in the ballooning debts of some countries.
Africa owes China tens of billions of dollars, and the numbers are swelling by the second. Kenya, for example, has a public debt of about $60 billion. Much of it's owed to China for the construction of several infrastructure projects. Kenyan development economist Anzete Were says African states find Chinese loans attractive, primarily because Beijing doesn't dictate terms for a project and lecture about human rights or good governance, as many Western lenders do.
When you deal with European and North American governments, they have a very clear idea of how they think development should happen. It's sort of this feeling that if you use our money, we want you to do it this way. African governments have really become quite tired of that.
She says China's own dramatic economic growth adds incentive to borrowers in Africa, whereas says China's rise tells African governments that the path to economic progress isn't all about free markets and democracy, which the West emphasizes. South African risk analyst Ronak Gopaldas warns against what he calls the myth that borrowing from China is easy, even though its loans involve less stringent conditions.
Whilst African leaders feel that they get a certain level of respect from China that they don't get from the West, there's no free lunch, and if they're unable to service their debt obligations, there will be consequences which could potentially undermine their sovereignty.
In Zambia, China has lent heavily for airport and power projects, and there are concerns those assets could come under Chinese control as the Lusaka government struggles to pay its debts. There's also growing concern on the continent and in the West that China will soon control much of tiny Djibouti, where Beijing has lent funds for ports and pipelines.
Djibouti's geostrategic position is very, very important. There's huge contestation amongst global partners around having a naval and military base there. It straddles the Indian Ocean, the Red Sea. It's very important to China. It's very important to European powers. It's very important to the Arab world as well, just given...
Djibouti has access to the Suez Canal, the shortest trade route between East and West. Gopaldas says if the West loses even partial access to the canal, it would suffer immense economic damage. He adds that Beijing's choice of Djibouti as the site for its first overseas military base says everything about China's future designs in the region. Were, however, says the view that China is somehow tricking Africa into debt infantilizes African leaders and absolves them of responsibility by underestimating their decision-making power.
The debt trap narrative makes Africa the passive player that's being acted upon, that is helpless, and there's this monstrous power that's coming in and taking advantage. And it really prevents the real issue, which is the accountability of our government in terms of how they use our public finances, how they use our taxes, and the debt that they get into.
Ultimately, says Were, the Chinese government cannot be blamed for the failure of some African administrations to manage their debts. She adds that African countries must improve their ability to sign good deals. Were says this requires employing skilled financial experts to use Chinese loans in the best ways possible, which also minimizes the chances of corruption and mismanagement. Gopaldas agrees that African nations must play the economic diplomacy game better, so that they take advantage of foreign powers' growing desire to have greater presence on the continent.
Are they putting all their eggs in the China basket, or are they kind of looking strategically at alternative partners as well? Because the Indians and the Japanese are also kind of very interested in expanding their influence in the Indian Ocean. The Russians are looking to invest and be a key partner in Africa again.
He says African policymakers must begin to embrace the fact that China isn't the only game in town. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, how young people overcome unemployment in Zimbabwe. That story is coming up right after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what is your most valuable possession?
My valuable possession right now will be my laptop, because I have a lot of confidential documents on it that are very dear to me and I can't afford to lose right now.
I think my smartphone that my dad bought for me, yeah, I treasure it so much because it was so expensive and I was so happy.
Being in school means so much to me. Yes, I know I've not yet finished, but I'm struggling to reach there because I know it is important to me and it will be something good to me.
My most valuable possession is a photo I took with an important personality in the entertainment industry, and it's an important possession to me because anytime I look at it, it encourages me and inspires me to attain higher heights.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202 630 8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202 630 8011.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus. Zimbabwe's unemployment rate remains high, with many young people out of options in their job searches. A group of young people in Zimbabwe is working to change that. Reporter Jose Zenivashi has more for VOA.
Decent Bajila explains what he and his colleagues are working on.
I work with other colleagues under an initiative that we have called the Team 2020, where we seek to assist employment seekers to apply, particularly those from less privileged backgrounds.
He explains there can be many challenges standing between an individual and employment. They include the lack of money to travel or to pay for internet access to find vacancies and apply for jobs. Bajila says he and his colleagues try to remove some of those challenges. He says the group is helping high school graduates apply for the government nursing program.
We did much focus on Matabeleland and the Midlands. We helped them, particularly with access to internet, because all applications are now done online and the others fail to get sufficient access to internet. In total, we had more than 300 young people that came through the process.
Bajila says the initiative used crowdfunding to roll out the program.
The reception has been quite good. People started bringing in the money. We got a lot in terms of local currency. We managed to fundraise something close to 4,000 pound. Some people were offering to say, I've got means by which I can pay bus fare for people. Some say, I'm willing to pay for accommodation. Here in Harare, we had a lady who offered space for four ladies over two nights.
He adds that some of the support has been from Zimbabweans abroad who paid for Airbnb accommodations for applicants who had to travel across the country for interviews. He says 150 young people the program helped were called for interviews. 60 of them have been shortlisted. Bajila says in the future, Team 2020 also will help individuals apply for training programs for educators and police and other public and private sector opportunities. Bajila says, long term, the group will be doing career guidance sessions in rural areas to help young adults get ideas for the career paths they want to follow. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinawashe from Harare.
Still in Zimbabwe, the remaining 400 Zimbabwean refugees in Botswana will return home in the coming days after registering for voluntary repatriation. The Botswana government had given refugees a year and deadline to register or risk forced removal. But some, mostly those who fled political violence, are reluctant to return. From Gaborone, Mkondisi Dube reports.
The first group of 135 Zimbabwean refugees was repatriated in mid-December. The Botswana government gave the migrants an ultimatum to register by December 31 for voluntary repatriation or they face deportation. Most of the remaining 400 refugees have registered for repatriation and will leave Botswana next week. This refugee, who did not want to give her name, did so reluctantly.
There was no option but to register for the repatriation. Otherwise, they were going to force us out. If you are deported, you know you live with nothing, no money, no property. It is not that we really want to return home.
However, some have asked to be allowed to remain in Botswana or to be sent to third countries rather than to return home. Wasu Chibi, who supported the opposition MTC before fleeing to Botswana a decade ago, says it is unsafe to return.
I was not brought into Botswana. I was not given any money to come to Botswana. With money or without money, I am in Botswana to stay. No matter deportation, no matter force, no matter what.
Begimpilo Weza, another MTC member, prefers to be transferred to a third country if he cannot remain in Botswana.
You remember when we received here in Botswana, this was regarded a political crisis. So when it is over, people should come to an agreement. They should come to a cessation clause whereby all international community bodies, human rights organizations will agree that really the country is safe for return.
The final repatriations are expected to begin this week, with each migrant receiving $300 as a settlement allowance. For VOA, this is Mkondisi Dube in Haburoni, Botswana.
We now turn to Nigeria, where a year ago, President Muhammad Buhari signed into law the Discrimination Against Persons with Disability Act to help the country's disabled. However, Nigeria's blind and visually impaired say they are still struggling against poverty and bias, with many forced to beg for a living. Ifoke Itang reports from Jos, Nigeria.
Sitting on a worn-out wooden stool in what appears to be his workshop, 72-year-old Samal Adamu is repairing a faulty generator using very unusual tools. After losing vision in both eyes 26 years ago, Adamu learned to spot engine faults through sound and touch. When people bring generators for repairs, I touch the parts and feel them, says Adamu. After that, I can tell what is wrong with the engine. Adamu makes less than $5 on every generator repair. He says it's barely enough to provide for his three wives and 19 children, but keeps him from begging on the streets. This work helps me provide food to feed myself, my wives, and children, he says. I don't receive assistance from anyone. There are over 1 million blind Nigerians and over 3 million with visual impairments. The Nigerian Association of the Blind says many are living in abject poverty.
You can't separate disability with poverty, because most of those of us that have visual impairment are from poor homes. Had it been our parents were well-to-do, maybe we would have gone to better hospitals for better treatment, we wouldn't have been blind.
Although Buhari signed the Discrimination Against Persons with Disabilities Act into law last January, Nigeria's visually impaired, like special education teacher Liki Idris, says they still face bias when looking for work.
When I go to any place to apply for a job and they turn me down, you know, I feel so dejected. What I feel those people are looking at is the impairment I'm going all about with.
Nigerian authorities plan to follow up the Disability Act by establishing a national commission for the disabled to ensure access to education and work. Ifyok Etang, for VOA News, Jos, Nigeria.
From Nigeria, we go to Southern Africa, where Malawi is distributing personal security alarms to people with albinism, a condition that causes whitening of skin from lack of pigmentation. Authorities hope the alarms will protect albinos from attacks by people who believe their body parts have magical powers. But the alarms have only a limited range, raising doubts about their effectiveness. Lamek Masina reports from Lilongwe.
Uvenda Jibidilola Stone was nearly abducted in March by three men pretending to be police officers. The men said they were searching houses of villagers suspected of keeping albino body parts, which are used across East Africa for so-called black magic. Last one was saved when the men failed to produce identity cards and villagers handed them over to the rural police. He says, I realized that I can be killed any day because of the way those people came. I was extremely terrified and I realized that I am being stalked. So since that time, I still live in fear. Police say at least 25 albinos have been killed in Malawi since 2014, and albino graves are often robbed, not of jewelry, but of bodies. So-called witch doctors use the bodies in potions or rituals believed to bring good luck, love, or wealth. Malawi authorities this year reacted to public pressure by distributing mobile personal security alarms to the country's estimated 10,000 albinos. Mary Navicha is the Minister of Gender and Disability.
As government, we are trying to create a conducive environment for the persons with albinism. That's why we are distributing security gadgets for them to be protected and for them to be safe in their communities.
Malawi's albinos initially refused the alarms when first offered in May because authorities stamped them as being a gift from President Peter Mutharika. The alarm sound is activated when the wearer pulls a safety pin, but can only be heard within a range of about 100 meters. Sherif Kaisi, political scientist at Blantyre International University, doubts the effectiveness of the sound.
The sound that it produces, you can agree with me that it's not that sound that can so alarming that people can say there is something happening. And it is not in our tradition as Malawians, in many cases, that when we hear the sound or the alarm, people start rushing to see what is happening over there.
Malawi police and local leaders are trying to educate people to react to any alarms. Laston says he feels a little safer with the alarm on, but the limited range deters him from traveling to earn money, so he is struggling to put food on the table. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Lilongwe.
African financial markets were rattled today after a U.S. strike killed an Iranian Major General Qasem Soleimani, head of the elite Quds force in Baghdad. Oil prices shot up more than 4% on fears of retaliatory strike by Iran. Nigeria, Angola, South Sudan, and Libya are among the top oil producers on the continent. Copper prices fell by nearly 1.5%. South Africa and the Democratic Republic of Congo are among the continent's biggest copper producers. One of the most heavily traded currencies on the continent, South Africa's rand fell nearly 2% against the US dollar as investors fled assets in emerging economies. That's our show for this Friday. We'll now leave you with the song Wachanika Kimia by Diamond.
Mana nambia nasibu mimi mtu mzima na wendo la kutegemea. Yano tokia jaribu kupiga kimya usidiriki hata kuongea. Mara nasikia vya aibu konda kwa jima eti ugomvi umekolea. Kuchunguza karibu ni binti moja kwa mitandao anachochea. Najaribu kunyamaza ile moyo utaki. Unanambia tisimba japunguruma uiseme haki. Unajaribu kunyamaza atalaiza tagio. Anasema walau nina kidogo. Na mashabiki Dangote wananambia mbona usemi chochote. Siuko na usiku zote ama ulezi unafanya uogope. Na media pande zote.
We've been listening to Diamond with the song Wachanika Kimia. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Have a safe and peaceful weekend, and we hope you'll join us again on Monday for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Mama kanambia oh nifunge mudomo nipato mudoko sana nisiseme kimia. Thank you.
jaribu, tajitahidi epuka yasije ni host.